It and understood. I said nothing. This was news to me. I let it settle. It sounded plausible, but it was a concept I'd need to consider at more length in the privacy of my own home. Was there ever someone who fulfilled that role in your life, Eleanor? Someone who you felt understood you? Someone who loved you just as you were, unconditionally? My first response was to say no, of course. Mummy most certainly did not fall into that category. Something, someone, was niggling at me, though, tugging at my sleeve. I tried to ignore her, but she wouldn't go away. That little voice, those little hands. Yes. No rush, Eleanor. Take your time. What do you remember? I took a breath. Back in that house on a good day. Stripes of sunshine on the carpet, a board game set out on the floor, a pair of dice, two brightly coloured counters, a day with more ladders than snakes, pale brown eyes, something about a dog. But I've never had a pet. I felt myself becoming distressed, confused, a churning in my stomach, a dull pain in my throat. There was a memory there, somewhere deep, somewhere too painful to touch. Okay, she said gently, passing me the much-needed box of man-sized tissues. Time's almost up now. She took out her diary. Shall we agree to meet at the same time next week and come back to this? I couldn't believe it. All that work. I was so close now, and she was throwing me out on the street again. After everything I'd shared, all the things I'd uncovered was about to keep uncovering. I threw the tissue on the floor. Go to hell, I said quietly. Chapter 32. Anger was good, she'd said, while I was putting my coat on. If I was finally getting in touch with my anger, then I was starting to do some important work, unpicking and addressing things that I'd buried too deep. I hadn't thought about it before, but I suppose I'd never really been angry before now. Irritated, bored, sad, yes, but not actually angry. I suppose she had a point. Perhaps things had happened that I ought to feel angry about. It wasn't an emotion I enjoyed feeling, and it certainly wasn't fair to direct it towards Dr. Maria Temple, who was, after all, only doing her job. I'd apologized profusely straight after my outburst, and she was very understanding, even seemed quite pleased. Still, I wouldn't be making a habit of telling people to go to hell. Obscenity is the distinguishing hallmark of a sadly limited vocabulary. On top of all this, I was trying to find a new routine, but it wasn't easy. For more than 9 years, I'd got up, gone to work, come home. At the weekends, I had my vodka. None of that would work now. I decided to clean the flat from top to bottom. I saw how grubby it was, how tired. It looked like I felt, unloved, uncared for. I imagined inviting someone, Raymond, I supposed, for lunch. I tried to see it through his eyes. There were things I could do to make it nicer, I realized, things that didn't cost much but which would make a big difference. Another houseplant, some brightly coloured cushions. I thought about Laura's house, how elegant it was. She lived alone, had a job, her own business even. She certainly seemed to have a life, not just an existence. She seemed happy. It must be possible, then. The bell made me jump, mid-clean. It wasn't a sound I heard often. I felt, as I usually did, slightly apprehensive as I unbolted the door and threw the locks, noted the slight increase in my heart rate, the gentle tremor in my hands. I peered around the chain. A youth in sports clothing stood on my doormat, his trainer-shod foot tapping. More than that, his whole body was vibrating with energy. His cap was on backwards. Why? Instinctively, I took a step back. Orphan, he said. Apprehensively, I nodded. He dipped down to the side of the door, out of sight, then reappeared with a huge basket filled with flowers wrapped in cellophane and ribbons. He made to hand it over and unlatched the chain and took it from him gingerly, fearing some sort of trick. He rummaged in his jacket pocket and pulled out a black electronic gadget. "Sign here, please," he said, handing me a plastic pencil which had horrifically been lurking behind his ear. I produced my special autograph, which he did not even glance at. "Cheers," he said, already skittering off down the stairs. I had never seen so much nervous energy contained in one human body. A tiny envelope, like a hamster's birthday card, was affixed to the cellophane. Inside a business card, plain white, bore the following message. "Get well soon, Eleanor. We are all thinking of you. Love and best wishes from Bob and everyone at By Design. Kiss, kiss, kiss." I took the basket into the kitchen and put it on the table. Thinking of me. The scent of a summer garden, sweet and heady, was released when I removed the cellophane. They'd been thinking of me. I sat down and stroked the petals of a red gerbera, and I smiled. Flowers placed carefully on the coffee table, I continued my slow progress around the flat, and as I cleaned, I thought about what it meant to make a home. I didn't have much experience to draw on. I opened all of the windows, tuned the radio until I found some inoffensive music, and scrubbed each room in turn. Some of the stains in the carpet wouldn't come out, but I managed to lift most of them. I filled 4 black bags with rubbish, old crosswords, dried-out pens, ugly knick-knacks that I'd collected over the years. I sorted out my bookshelf, making a pile to take and, in some cases, return to the charity shop. I'd recently finished reading a management tome which seemed to be aimed at psychopaths with no common sense, quite a dangerous combination. I've always enjoyed reading, but I've never been sure how to select appropriate material. There are so many books in the world, how do you tell them all apart? How do you know which one will match your tastes and interests? That's why I just pick the first book I see. There's no point in trying to choose. The covers are of very little help because they always say only good things, and I've found out to my cost that they're rarely accurate. Exhilarating, dazzling, hilarious. No. The only criterion I have is that the books must look clean, which means that I have to disregard a lot of potential reading material in the charity shop. I don't use the library for the same reason, although obviously, in principle and reality, libraries are life-enhancing palaces of wonder. It's not you, libraries, it's me, as the popular saying goes. The thought of books passing through so many unwashed hands, people reading them in the bath, letting their dogs sit on them, picking their nose and wiping the results on the pages, people eating cheesy crisps and then reading a few chapters without washing their hands first, I just can't. No, I look for books with one careful owner. The books in Tesco are nice and clean. I sometimes treat myself to a few tomes from there on payday. At the end of the process, the flat was clean and very nearly empty. I made a cup of tea and looked around the living room. It just needed pictures on the walls and a rug or two, some new plants. Sorry, Polly. The flowers would have to do for now. I took a deep breath, picked up the poof and squashed it into a bin liner. It was quite a fight to get it in. As I grappled with it, I thought about what I must look like. My arms wrapped around a giant frog, wrestling it to the ground. I snorted a bit, and then I laughed and laughed until my chest hurt. When I stood up and finally tied the handles, a jaunty pop music song was playing, and I realized what I felt. Happy. It was such a strange, unusual feeling. Light. Calm. As though I'd swallowed sunshine. Only this morning I'd been furious, and now I was calm and happy. I was gradually getting used to feeling the range of available human emotions, their intensity, the rapidity with which they could change. Until now, any time that emotions, feelings, had threatened to unsettle me, I'd drink them down fast, drown them. That had allowed me to exist, but I was starting to understand that I needed, wanted, something more than that now. I took the rubbish downstairs, and when I came back into the flat, I noticed that it smelled lemony. It was a pleasure to enter. I didn't normally notice my surroundings, I realized. It was like my walk to Maria Temple's office this morning. When you took a moment to see what was around you, noticed all the little things, it made you feel lighter. Perhaps if you had friends or a family, they might help you to notice things more often. They might even point them out to you. I turned off the radio and sat in silence on the sofa, drinking another cup of tea. All I could hear was the breeze whistling softly through the open window and two men laughing in the street below. It was a weekday afternoon. Normally I'd be at work, watching the hands tick round until 5, waiting for pizza and vodka time, and then Friday night and the 3 long sleeps until Monday. With the exception of the shot I'd had in the pub, I hadn't drunk any vodka for some weeks now. I'd always thought that it helped me sleep, but in fact I'd been sleeping more deeply than ever before, untroubled by disturbing dreams. An electronic noise startled me and I almost spilled my tea. Someone had sent me a text message. I ran into the hall for my phone. The little envelope flashed.
"You about early evening? Can I come over? Got a surprise for you. R. Kiss."
A surprise? I replied immediately. Yes, Eleanor Rowe. No one had ever asked to come and visit me before. The social worker made an appointment and the meter reader just turned up. I was conscious that Raymond's previous visits had not been very pleasant for him or me, and decided to try to make amends. I put on my jerkin and headed out to the corner shop. Mr. Dewan looked up from reading a newspaper at the sound of the electronic alert. It must drive him to distraction, bleeping all day like that. He smiled cautiously at me. I took a basket and got some milk, Earl Grey tea bags and a lemon to slice in case Raymond preferred his tea that way. I spent a considerable amount of time in the aisles, somewhat overwhelmed by the choice. In the end, I plumped for Garibaldi biscuits, throwing in a packet of pink wafers too. Apparently it's nice to offer guests an option. I wondered if Raymond might prefer something savoury, and so I got some cream crackers and a packet of cheese slices, all bases covered. I stood in line with my basket, not eavesdropping, but nonetheless forced to overhear the conversation of the couple in front of me as we waited our turn. Eventually, I felt compelled to intervene and provide assistance. "It's Dejean," I said. No reply. I sighed and leaned forward again. "Dejean," I repeated, speaking slowly and clearly and, I thought, in a passable French accent.
"Sorry?"
the woman said, not sounding sorry at all. The man simply stared at me in a manner best described as mildly hostile. "Neither of you can remember the word for the, as you described it, ceramic pot with a pointy lid that Judith, whoever she is, had put on her wedding list, leading you," here I indicated the woman with a gentle nod of my head, "to describe her as a pretentious cow." I was quite enjoying the occasional use of the waggling finger gesture now that I got the hang of it. Neither of them spoke, so I felt emboldened to continue. "A tagine is a traditional cooking vessel of North African origin," I said helpfully, "generally made from fired clay and decorated with a brightly coloured glaze. It's also the name of the stew that is cooked within it." The man's mouth had fallen open slightly and the woman's had slowly changed shape to form a very thin, very tight line. She turned back to him and they began to whisper together, looking round more than once to steal a quick glance at me. Nothing more was said, although they glared at me as they walked out, having paid for their goods. Not a word of thanks. I gave them a little wave. Mr. Dewan smiled warmly at me when I finally reached the till. The levels of rudeness and the complete lack of awareness of the comme il faut amongst the general population never ceases to disappoint me, Mr. Dewan, I said, shaking my head.
"Miss Oliphant," he said, smiling in an understanding way. "How nice to see you again. You are looking very well."
I felt myself beaming in response. "Thank you very much, Mr. Dewan," I said. "It's nice to see you too. Pleasant day today, is it not? He nodded, still smiling, and scanned my items. When he'd done that, his smile faltered slightly.
Will there be anything else today, Miss Oliphant?
The bottles behind him glittered in the glare of the overhead lights, red and gold and clear.
Yes, I said. I'd almost forgotten.
I leaned over to the newspaper stand and picked up a telegraph. I was itching to get back to the crossword again. Back home, I lit the gas fire and laid out the teacups. I wished that they matched, but I was sure Raymond wouldn't mind. I sliced the lemon and arranged the biscuits as alternating spokes on a wheel on my nicest plate, the one with the flowers on it. I decided to keep the savoury items in reserve. No need to go crazy. Being somewhat out of practice, I was only halfway through the crossword when the doorbell rang, a bit later than I'd been expecting. Due to hunger pangs, I'd been forced to have a few biscuits, so a couple of the spokes on the wheel were missing now. Too bad. Raymond was holding a cardboard box with handles in one hand and a huge, bulging plastic bag in the other. He seemed very out of breath, placed both items gently on my hall carpet without being asked, and started to take off his jacket, still puffing and blowing like a beached porpoise. Smoking kills. He passed me his jacket and I looked at it for a moment before realizing I was supposed to hang it up. I didn't have anywhere suitable, so I folded it into a square as best I could, and then put it on the floor in the corner of the hall. He didn't look very pleased, although I had no idea why. It wasn't an expensive-looking jacket. I showed him into the living room and offered him tea. He seemed quite excitable.
"Later, maybe. I've got to tell you about the surprise first, Eleanor," he said.
I sat down. "Go ahead," I said, bracing myself. "My experience of surprises is limited and not particularly positive." He fetched the cardboard box from the hall and placed it on the floor.
"Now," he said, "you don't have to do this. My mum will be more than happy to oblige. I just thought, well..."
He opened the lid very gently and I instinctively took a step back. "Come on, darling," he said in a soft, crooning voice that I'd never heard him use before. "Don't be frightened." He reached in and lifted out the fattest cat I'd ever seen. It was, in theory, jet black, the darkness extending even to its nose and whiskers, but its thick fur was covered in bald patches which looked all the paler by comparison. He held it close to his chest and continued to whisper endearments in its ear. The creature looked distinctly underwhelmed.
"What do you think?" he said.
I stared into its green eyes and it stared back. I took a step forward and he offered her to me. There was a bit of awkwardness as he passed her over, trying to transfer her bulk from his arms into mine, and then all at once it was done. I held her like a baby, close against my chest, and felt, rather than heard, her deep, sonorous purring. Oh, the warm weight of her. I buried my face in what remained of her fur and felt her turn her head towards me as she gently sniffed my hairline. Eventually I looked up. Raymond was unpacking the other bag, which contained a disposable litter tray, a squishy cushion bed, and a small box of kibble. The cat squirmed in my arms and landed on the carpet with a heavy thump. She strolled over to the litter tray, squatted down and urinated loudly, maintaining extremely assertive eye contact with me throughout. After the deluge, she lazily kicked over the traces with her back legs, scattering litter all over my freshly cleaned floor. A woman who knew her own mind and scorned the conventions of polite society, we were going to get along just fine. Raymond declined all of the biscuits on offer and also the tea. He requested beer or coffee, but I had neither. Taking care of guests was more challenging than I'd thought. Eventually he settled for a glass of water, which he didn't even drink. Desi, one of his flatmates, had rescued the cat from the back court of his flats last night, he told me. Someone had put her in a metal dustbin and set it alight. Desi had heard the screams when he was returning home from work.
I stood up and ran towards the bathroom, where I vomited up the pink wafers. Raymond knocked gently on the door, but I shouted at him to leave me alone. When I came back, both he and the cat were sitting separately on the sofa. I sat down in the chair opposite, and they both watched me carefully.
"Who would do such a thing, Raymond?" I said, when I could finally speak.
Both he and the cat looked sad.
"Sick fucks," said Raymond, shaking his head. "Daisy brought her in and we made sure she was okay. He's allergic, though, so we can't keep her. I was going to take her to the cat's protection or see if my mum wanted another one, but then, I don't know, I thought she might be a nice bit of company for you, Eleanor. Just say if not, it's a big deal having a pet, a lot of responsibility."
This was tricky. On the one hand, I could not deny that I was drawn to her. She had an undeniably rakish, alopecia-based charm and a devil-may-care attitude that would melt the hardest of hearts. I could tell that she was a cat that brooked no nonsense. She was, at the same time, a vulnerable creature, one which needed looking after. Therein lay the rub. Was I up to the task? I thought back to the counselling sessions, how we'd talked about thinking things through rationally, recognising unhelpful patterns of behaviour and being brave enough to try doing things differently. "Come on, Eleanor," I said to myself. "Be brave. This is not the same as before, not even close to it. She's a cat and you're a grown woman. You're more than capable of doing this." "I will assume the mantle of care, Raymond," I said firmly. "This creature will be looked after assiduously." He smiled.
"I'm sure she will be. She looks at home here already, right enough," he said.
The cat was now sprawled across the sofa cushions, to all intents and purposes asleep, although one ear twitched intermittently as she monitored the conversation.
"What are you going to call her?" he said.
I put my head on one side while I considered this. After a while, Raymond stood up.
"I'm going to nip downstairs for a fag. I'll leave the door on the latch," he said.
"Don't blow the smoke towards my windows," I shouted after him. When he came back 10 minutes later, I told him that her name was Glen. He laughed.
"Glen? That's a boy's name, surely."
I thought about all of those red labels, all those empty bottles. "She's named after an old friend," I said. The next day, I woke with a start to find Glen lying beside me, her head on the pillow and her body under the covers, just like a human. Her huge green eyes were staring intently at me as though she had willed me awake. She followed me into the kitchen and I gave her some water, which she ignored, and some kibble, which she bolted down and promptly vomited back up onto the kitchen floor. I turned away to get some cleaning materials from under the sink, but when I looked around, she was eating her sick back up again. "Good girl, Glen," I said. "Low maintenance." Raymond had only brought the bare minimum for her to spend the night, so while she was snoozing on top of the duvet, I snuck out of the flat and took the bus to the retail park, where I knew there was a big pet supplies store. I bought her a bigger, comfier bed, a proper litter tray with a covered roof for privacy, 4 different kinds of wet and dry food, and a sack of organic cat litter. I picked up a bottle of oil that was supposed to be good for her coat. A teaspoon was to be mixed in with her food every day. I didn't care if her coat grew back or not because she was fine just as she was, but I felt that she might be more comfortable without the bare patches of skin. She didn't strike me as the type to enjoy playing with toys, but just in case, I bought a glittery ball and a huge fluffy mouse the size of an old man's slipper, which was stuffed with catnip. When I took the trolley to the till, I realised that I was going to have to call a taxi to get it all home. I felt quite proud of myself. The driver wouldn't help me carry it upstairs, so it took me a few trips, and I was sweating by the time I got everything indoors. The expedition had taken over 2 hours from start to finish. Glen was still asleep on the duvet. I spent the day pottering around the flat. Glen was good company, quiet, self-contained, mostly asleep. That evening, as I sat with a cup of tea and listened to a play on the radio, she jumped onto my lap and began kneading my thighs with her paws,
claws partially unsheathed. It was slightly uncomfortable, but I could tell that she meant it kindly. After doing that for a minute or so, she settled herself carefully onto my lap and went to sleep. I needed to go to the bathroom about 20 minutes later, a necessity exacerbated by the fact that she was far from slender and was lounging with her full body weight directly atop my bladder. I tried to gently shift her to one side. She resisted. I tried again. On the third attempt, she got to her feet slowly, arched her back, and then shuddered out a long, judgmental sigh before dropping down onto the floor and waddling off towards her new bed. Once ensconced there, she glared at me as I left the room, maintaining the expression when I returned and continued to glower at me throughout the evening. I wasn't worried. I dealt with far, far worse things than an irritated feline. Raymond paid a visit again, a few days later, to see how Glenn was settling in. I'd invited him and his mother, as he'd mentioned that she was keen, and as a cat obsessive, I imagined she'd enjoy meeting Glenn. In any case, there were still plenty of biscuits left over from his previous visit, so it was not as though it was any trouble. They arrived in a black cab, which Mrs. Gibbons was very pleased about. "The driver was lovely, Eleanor, wasn't he, Raymond?" she said. Raymond nodded, and I thought I detected a hint, just a tiny one, of weariness, as though it wasn't the first time she'd gone over the topic during their short journey from the south to the west of the city.
"Oh, he couldn't have been nicer. Helped me in and out of the taxi, held the door open while I got my walking frame."
"That's right, Mum," he said, tucking her walking frame into the corner of the living room while she settled herself on the sofa. Glenn, ever their iconoclast, had immediately gone to bed, my bed, as soon as they arrived, and there was nothing to see of her but a lightly snoring lump under the duvet. Mrs. Gibbons was disappointed, but I left her to peruse some photos on my phone while I went to make tea. Raymond joined me in the kitchen, leaning against the worktop while he watched me pour. He placed a carrier bag next to me.
"It's nothing much," he said.
I peered inside. There was a white cardboard box from a bakery, tied with ribbon. There was also a tiny tin of gourmet cat food.
"How lovely," I said, delighted.
"I wasn't sure what you liked. Didn't want to come empty-handed," Raymond said, blushing. "I thought, well, you seem like the kind of person who likes nice things," he said, looking up at me. "You deserve to have nice things," he said firmly.
This was strange. I must confess I was somewhat lost for words for a moment or two. Did I deserve nice things? "It's funny, you know, Raymond," I said. "Growing up with Mummy was very disorientating. Sometimes she gave us nice things, other times not. I mean, one week we'd be dipping quail's eggs in celery salt and shucking oysters. The next we'd be starving. I mean, you know, literally deprived of food and water," I said. His eyes widened. "Everything was always extreme, so extreme with her," I said, nodding to myself. "I used to long for normal, you know, 3 meals a day, ordinary stuff. Tomato soup, mashed potatoes, cornflakes." I untied the ribbons and looked inside the box. The sponge cake inside was an artful confection, chocolate ganache scattered with bright raspberry jewels. It was an ordinary luxury, which Raymond had chosen especially for me. "Thank you," I said, feeling tears threaten to well up. There was really nothing else I needed to say.
"Thanks for inviting us, Eleanor," he said. "Mum loves to get out, but she doesn't often get the chance."
"You're welcome any time. Both of you are," I said, and I meant it. I set the cake on a tray with the tea things, but before I could pick it up, Raymond did the honours. I followed behind. He had had his hair cut, I noticed.
"How are you feeling, Eleanor?" Mrs. Gibbons asked once we were all settled. "Raymond mentioned that you'd been a bit under the weather recently."
She wore an expression of mild, polite concern, nothing more, and I realised, flushed with gratitude, that he hadn't provided her with any details.
"I'm feeling much better, thank you," I said. "Raymond's been keeping an eye on me. I'm very lucky."
He looked surprised. His mother did not.
"He's got a heart of gold, my boy," she said, nodding.
Raymond's face looked like Glenn's did the time she noticed that I'd seen her trying and failing to jump from the sofa to the windowsill. I laughed.
"We're embarrassing you," I said.
"Oh, you're embarrassing you," he said, rabbiting away about nothing like a proper pair of old biddies. "Anyone want some more tea?"
He reached forward for the teapot and I saw he was smiling. The Gibbons were easy, pleasant company. We were all slightly surprised at how quickly time had passed when the pre-booked taxi honked its horn in irritation an hour later, I think, and their departure was, by necessity, somewhat rushed.
"Your turn to come to me next time, Eleanor," she said, as they struggled out of the door with the walking frame, Raymond shrugging on his jacket at the same time.
I nodded. She kissed me quickly on the cheek, the scarred one, and I didn't even flinch.
"Come again with Raymond one Sunday. Have your tea. Stay for a while," she whispered.
I nodded again. Raymond lumbered past me, then, before I could do anything about it, leaned in and kissed me on the cheek like his mother had done.
"See you at work," he said,
and he was off, manhandling both her and her wheels down the stairs in a very precarious fashion. I put my hand to my face. They were quite a kissy family, the Gibbons. Some families were like that. I washed up the cups and plates, at which point Glenn finally decided to make an appearance. "That wasn't very sociable, Glenn," I said. She stared up at me and let out a short sound, not really a meow, more of a chirp, strangely. The import, namely that she didn't give a fig, was abundantly clear. I spooned the special cat food that Raymond had brought into her bowl. This was met with considerable enthusiasm, although regretfully her table manners were sadly reminiscent of her benefactors. Raymond had left his tabloid newspaper behind on the chair in the living room. Unfortunately, he often carried one rolled up in his back pocket. I leafed through it, just in case it had a halfway decent crossword, and stopped at page 9, my eyes drawn to the headline.
"Glasgow Evening Times. Entertainment news. Pilgrim pioneers discover America. Glasgow band tipped to be bigger than Biffy. Scottish band Pilgrim Pioneers are celebrating this week after reaching number 5 in the American Billboard Top 100. The Glasgow-based four-piece looks set to crack the lucrative US market after years of gigging locally in pubs and clubs. Their single, Don't Miss You, written after the acrimonious departure of their previous frontman, was picked up last month by an industry insider via YouTube. Since then, it's been broadcast nightly across the USA as the soundtrack to a big-budget advert for a telecoms company. The band are set to head stateside next month on a coast-to-coast tour." Reading this, I was taken straight back to another place, another person. The person I was trying to be and the changes I was trying and failing to make to myself and in my life. The singer wasn't ever the point, really. Maria Temple had helped me see that. In my eagerness to change, to connect with someone, I'd focused on the wrong thing, the wrong person. On the charge of being a catastrophic disaster, a failed human being, I was starting to find myself, with Maria's help, not guilty. The story didn't mention what Johnny Lomond was doing now. It really didn't matter. I folded up the newspaper. I could line Glenn's litter tray with it later. At Johnny L. Rock's, 7 hours.
"Massive congrats to the guys. Great news and really, really well deserved. So chuffed for them. Hashtag USA. Hashtag big time. No likes." At Johnny L. Rock's, 44 minutes. "Fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuckity, fuck, fuck." Later deleted.
Chapter 33. Maria seemed in a good mood when I arrived at her office, and I was too. It was an effort to switch my brain to alert mode when she started talking about the past again.
We haven't spoken much about the fire. I wonder, are you happy to talk a bit about it?
I nodded wearily.
Good. Now, can you try closing your eyes for me, please, Eleanor? Sometimes it's easier to access memories that way. Take a deep breath in and then let it all out. Great. And another. Good. Now, I want you to think back. You're at home and it's the day before the fire. What do you remember? Anything? Take your time. I'd been feeling so light and free earlier, so centred in myself that I hadn't had a chance to prepare myself properly for this. As I closed my eyes and exhaled to Maria's count, I had the worrying realisation that before I was even properly aware of it, my brain was off accessing memories and places I didn't want it to go, scurrying into rooms before I'd had a chance to block them off. My body felt heavy, in contrast to my mind which floated balloon-like just beyond my reach. Now that it was happening, though, I accepted it with equanimity. There was a certain pleasure in ceding control.
Mummy. She's angry. Mummy was sleeping, but we've woken her up again. Mummy's had enough of us now.
I feel tears on my cheeks as I relate this, but I don't feel particularly sad. It's as though I'm describing a film.
That's great, Eleanor. You're doing really well, Maria said. Can you tell me more about Mummy?
My voice is tiny.
I don't want to, I say.
You're doing great, Eleanor. Let's try to keep going. So about Mummy? I said nothing for the longest time, allowing my mind to wander where it needed to go in that house, letting the memories out like trapped birds. Finally, I whispered two words.
Where's Marianne?
Chapter 34. Sunday. I had to leave the house at 12 to meet Raymond for lunch. Glenn was dozing in her new bed and I used the camera function on my mobile telephone to take some more shots of her. In the final picture, she had one paw covering her eyes as if to block out the light. I knelt down on the floor beside her and buried my face in the biggest patch of fur. She wriggled slightly, then increased the volume of her purring. I kissed the softness on the top of her head. "See you later, Glenn," I said. "I won't be long." She appeared blissfully untroubled by my imminent departure. When I was ready to leave, I opened the door as quietly as I could and tiptoed into the living room to check if she was still asleep. I found her on top of the giant catnip-stuffed mouse, both she and the rodent facing me, its glazed button eyes staring straight ahead. She had her front paws thrown over its mousy shoulders and was lazily kneading them while she humped it energetically from behind. I left them to it. Ever since the session, all I could think about was Marianne. Marianne, Marianne, Marianne. I turned the name over and over in my mind like a coin between my fingers. Dr. Temple had asked me to prepare myself to talk about her again in our next session. I wasn't sure how I felt about that. Is knowing always better than not knowing? Discuss. Raymond, untroubled by philosophical questions, was already there when I arrived at the Black Dog, reading the Sunday Mail and sipping a pint. "Sorry I'm late," I said. His face was paler than usual, and when he stood up to hug me, I could smell old as well as new beer, in addition to the usual reek of cigarettes.
"How's it going?"
he said, his voice sounding scratchy. "Well, how are you?" I said. He didn't look well. He groaned.
"I nearly texted you to cancel, to be honest," he said. "I had a bit of a late one last night."
"Did you and Laura go on a date?" I said. He boggled at me.
"How on earth do you know that?"
he asked, sounding incredulous. I remembered something I'd seen Billy do in the office and tapped the side of my nose with my index finger knowingly. He laughed.
"I think you might have a bit of witch in you, Eleanor," he said.
I shrugged. I even had a black cat now to prove it. "I bumped into Laura a while back, actually," I explained. She told me you were seeing each other. He took a big gulp of his pint.
Right, yeah, she's been in touch a few times asking if I wanted to meet up. We went to see a film last night, had a couple of drinks afterwards.
That sounds nice, I said. Is she your girlfriend now, then? He signalled to the waiter to bring him another pint.
Laura's a lovely girl, he said, but I don't think I'm going to be seeing her again.
A staff member brought Raymond's beer and some menus, and I asked for a dandelion and burdock. Weirdly, considering it was a smart bar in the city centre, they didn't have any, so I had to make do with a Dr. Pepper. Why not? I said. Laura's very glamorous. Raymond sighed.
It's a bit more complicated than that, Eleanor, isn't it? He said. I think she's probably a bit high maintenance for me, if you know what I mean.
Not really, no, I said.
She's not my type, to be honest.
He took a noisy mouthful of beer.
I mean, looks are important, of course they are, but you've got to be able to have a laugh. Enjoy each other's company too, you know. I'm not sure me and Laura have got that much in common.
I shrugged, not knowing how best to respond. It was hardly my area of expertise. We were silent for a moment. He was looking terribly pale and uncomfortable, classic hangover symptoms. Thankfully, I never suffered from them, blessed as I am with an iron constitution. I ordered an omelette made by the chef, Arnold Bennett, and Raymond went for the full cooked breakfast with extra fried bread.
I had quite a lot of Jack Daniels with Daisy after I got home last night, he explained. That should soak it up.
Don't make a habit of the drinks, Raymond, I said sadly. You don't want to end up like me, do you? Raymond reached for my arm, held it for a moment.
You're doing just fine, Eleanor, he said.
The food came and I tried not to look at Raymond as he ate. It was never a pretty sight. I wondered how Glenn was doing. Would it be possible to bring her out somewhere like this if she could sit in some sort of high chair at the table with us? I could see no reason against it but for the small-minded anti-feline contingent who might complain. Look, Raymond, I said, thrusting my phone in his face. He glanced at the first four pictures.
Oh, that's nice, Eleanor, he said. She looks really settled at your place.
Keep scrolling, I said. He flicked through a few more in a desultory fashion. I could tell he was losing interest. Pearls before swine. We talked about inconsequential matters as we waited for our coffee. When it arrived, there was a lull in the conversation and Raymond poured a sachet of sugar onto the table. He began to draw in the grains with his forefinger, humming tunelessly as he tended to do when he was feeling anxious. His cuticles were bitten and his nails didn't look too clean. He could be such an annoying man sometimes.
Eleanor, he said, look, I've got something to tell you, and you've got to promise not to be angry with me.
I sat back and waited for him to continue.
I've been doing some research online about your mum, about what happened back then.
I stared at the grains of sugar. How could each one be so tiny and yet so perfectly angular?
Eleanor, he said. I'm not sure if what I found is right, but I googled arson and the year it happened and London, and there are some newspaper articles you might want to take a look at. We don't have to if you don't want to. I just wanted you to know in case, well, in case you changed your mind about finding stuff out.
I went to the happy place in my mind for a moment, the pink and white fluffy place with bluebirds and gently babbling streams and now a semi-bald cat purring noisily.
Where did you say your mum is these days?
He asked, very gently. I don't know, I mumbled. She's the one who contacts me. It's never the other way around. I tried to fathom his expression. I find it hard to work out people's expressions sometimes. The cryptic crossword is much, much easier. If I had to guess what was showing on his face, I would have said sadness, pity, fear. Nothing good. But the underlying feeling was one of kindness, gentleness. He was sad and afraid for me, but he wouldn't hurt me and didn't have the slightest desire to do so. I took some comfort in that.
Look, we won't talk about it any more, okay? I just want you to say that if anything comes back to you, like in counselling or whatever, I might be able to give you some answers, you know? But only if you want them, he added quickly.
I thought about this. I began to feel the vague inklings of irritation. Raymond, I said, I really don't think it's appropriate for you to try to direct me towards this, not before I'm ready. I'm making perfectly good progress on my own, you know, I told him.
Be patient, Marianne. I'm coming.
I looked at his face, which was even paler now than when he first sat down. His mouth hung open very slightly and his eyes were glassy and tired. It wasn't an attractive look.
You're not the only person who knows how to use a search engine, you know. It's my life, and when I'm good and ready, I'm more than capable,
I treated him to one of my more direct looks, of finding out exactly what happened for myself. He nodded and started to speak. I held up my hand, palm facing forward, to stop him. It was a very rude gesture, and I must confess to an illicit thrill of pleasure as I made it. I followed this up by taking a long, pointed draught of my Dr. Pepper. Unfortunately, it was almost finished, and the straw made a very unpleasant slurping sound, but I think I managed to get my point across quite effectively nonetheless. After I finished my drink, I caught the waiter's eye and indicated that I'd like him to bring the bill. Raymond had his head in his hands, not saying anything. I felt a rush of pain in my chest. I'd hurt his feelings. Raymond. I put my hand over my mouth and felt tears form. He looked up at me, then leaned over and took both my hands quite assertively in his. He puffed out some stale air from inside his hairy little beard.
I'm so sorry.
We both spoke the words at exactly the same time. We tried again and the same thing happened. Suddenly I laughed and he did too. Short bursts at first, and then for longer. It was proper, genuine laughter, the kind that makes your whole body shake. My mouth was wide open, my breath slightly wheezy, my eyes shut tight. I felt vulnerable and yet very relaxed and comfortable. I imagined that vomiting or going to the lavatory in front of him would feel the same way.
Look, it's totally my fault, he said when we'd finally calmed down. I'm so sorry if I upset you, Eleanor. I shouldn't even have brought it up, especially today when I'm hungover. My brain feels mashed, he said. You're absolutely right. It's your business and your decision, 100%.
He was still holding onto my hands. It was extremely pleasant. It's fine, Raymond, I said, and I meant it. I'm sorry if I overreacted. I know that you're a kind man who means well and you're only trying to help. I ventured a small smile at the sight of his face, which was full of relief. He let go of my hands very gently. I hadn't really noticed his eyes before. They were green, flecked with brown, very unusual. He smiled again, then put his palms up to his face and rubbed it, groaning quietly.
Christ, he said. I can't believe I've got to visit my mum now and see the cats. Just want to crawl back to bed and sleep until Tuesday.
I tried not to smile and paid the bill. He protested, but I took full advantage of his weakened state.
Do you want to come with me? He said. She'd love to see you.
I didn't even consider it. No, thank you, not today, Raymond, I said. Glenn will have had a bowel movement by now, and I don't like to leave her feces in the tray for more than an hour or two, in case she needs to urinate again afterwards. Raymond stood up quickly.
I'll just nip into the gents, he said.
I bought some cat food for Glen on the way home. The thing about Glen is that, despite her offhand manner, she loves me. I know she's only a cat, but it's still love, animals, people. It's unconditional, and it's both the easiest and the hardest thing in the world. Sometimes, after counselling sessions, I desperately wanted to buy vodka, lots of it, take it home and drink it down, but in the end I never did. I couldn't, for lots of reasons, one of which was that if I wasn't fit to, then who would feed Glen? She isn't able to take care of herself. She needs me.
It isn't annoying, her need. It isn't a burden. It's a privilege. I'm responsible. I chose to put myself in a situation where I'm responsible. Wanting to look after her, a small, dependent, vulnerable creature, is innate, and I don't even have to think about it. It's like breathing. For some people. Chapter 35. We had increased our counselling sessions to twice a week, which had sounded excessive when Maria first proposed it, but I was finding, to my surprise, that this was barely enough. I hoped I wasn't turning into one of those needy people, though, the kind who are always droning on about themselves and their problems. Boring. I was slowly getting used to talking about my childhood, having spent the best part of 30 years studiously avoiding the subject. That said, every time the topic of Marianne came up, I sidestepped it. Before each session, I told myself that this would be the right time to talk about her, but then, when it came to it, I just couldn't do it. Today, Dr. Temple had asked about Marianne again, of course, and when I'd shaken my head, she'd suggested that it might be helpful to think about my childhood as two discrete periods, before and after the fire, as a way of getting to the topic of Marianne. Yes, I said, it might be helpful, but very, very painful. So what's your happiest memory from before the fire? She said. I thought hard. Several minutes went by. I remember moments here and there, fragments, but I can't think of a complete incident, I said. No, wait, a picnic at school. It must have been the end of term or something like that. We all were outside at any rate in the sunshine. It wasn't much to go on, and certainly not a detailed recollection. What was it about that day that made you feel so happy, do you think? She spoke gently. I felt safe, I said, and I knew Marianne was safe too. Yes, that was it. Marianne, don't think too hard. That's right, her nursery class was there that day too. We all got a packed lunch, cheese sandwiches and an apple. The sunlight, the picnic. Marianne and I had walked home together after school as we always did, going as slowly as we could and telling each other about our day. The walk home wasn't long. It was never long enough. She was funny, a gifted mimic. It hurt to remember how much she made me laugh. School had been a place of refuge. Teachers asked how you got your cuts and bruises, sent you to the nurse to have them dressed. The knit nurse combed your hair gently, so gently, said you could keep the elastics because you'd been such a good girl. School dinners. I could relax at school, knowing Marianne was at nursery, safe and warm. The little ones had their own special peg to hang the coats on. She loved it there. It wasn't long after the picnic that Mummy found out Mrs. Rose had been asking about my bruises. We were homeschooled after that, all day, every day. No more escaping from 9 till 4, Monday to Friday. Worse and worse, quicker and quicker, hotter and hotter fire. I brought it on myself as usual, my own stupid fault, stupid Eleanor, and worst of all, I dragged Marianne into it too. She'd done nothing wrong. She'd never done anything wrong. Dr. Temple pushed the tissues towards me, and I wiped the tears from my cheeks. You mentioned Marianne a lot there, she said gently, when you were talking about your day-to-day life. I was ready to say it out loud. She's my sister, I said. We sat for a moment, and I let the words crystallize. There she was, Marianne, my little sister, my missing piece, my absent friend. The tears were coursing down my cheeks now, and Maria let me sob until I was ready to speak. I don't want to talk about what happened to her, I said. I'm not ready to do that. Maria Temple was very calm. Don't worry, Eleanor. We'll take this one step at a time. Acknowledging that Marianne is your sister is a huge thing.
We'll get to the rest in time.
I wish I could talk about it now, I said, furious with myself. But I can't.
Of course, Eleanor, she said calmly. She paused. Do you think that's because you can't remember what happened to Marianne? Or is it because you don't want to? Her voice was very gentle. I don't want to, I said slowly, quietly. I rested my elbows on my knees and put my head in my hands. Be gentle with yourself, Eleanor, Maria said. You're doing incredibly well. I almost laughed. It certainly didn't feel like I was doing well. Before and after the fire. Something fundamental had gone missing in the flames. Marianne. What do I do? I said, desperate suddenly to move forward, to get better, to live. How do I fix this? How do I fix me? Dr. Temple put down her pen and spoke firmly but gently. You're doing it already, Eleanor. You're braver and stronger than you give yourself credit for. Keep going. When she smiled at me then, her whole face crinkled into warm lines. I dropped my head again, desperate to hide the emotion that flamed there, the lump in my throat, the pricking of more tears, the swell of warmth. I was safe here. I'd talk more about my sister soon, however hard it was going to be. See you next week, then, I said. When I looked up, she was still smiling. Later that day, Glenn and I were watching a televisual game in which people with a fatally flawed understanding of statistics, specifically of probability theory, selected numbered boxes, each containing a check, to be opened in turn, in the hope of unearthing a six-figure sum. They based their selections on wildly unhelpful factors such as their birth date or that of a person they cared about, their house number or, worst of all, a good feeling about a particular integer. Humans are idiots, Glenn, I said, kissing the top of her head and then burying my face into her fur, which had grown back with such resplendence that she could now afford to shed it all over my clothes and furniture with gay abandon. She purred her assent. The doorbell rang. Glenn yawned extravagantly, then jumped down from my lap. I wasn't expecting anyone. I stood before the door, thinking that I ought to get one of those spy holes installed so that I would know who was there before I unlocked it. I found the trite theatricality of it rather dull. Who's behind the door? Boring. I don't like pantomimes or whodunits. I like to have all the relevant information at my disposal at the earliest opportunity so that I can start to formulate my response. I opened the door to find Keith, Sammy's son, standing on the doorstep, looking nervous. Mildly surprising, I invited him in. By the time Keith was sitting on my sofa with a cup of tea, Glenn had disappeared. She only really enjoyed her own company. She tolerated mine, but fundamentally she was a recluse at heart, like J.D. Salinger or the Unabomber. Thanks for the tea, Eleanor. I can't stay long, though, Keith said, after we'd finished exchanging the usual pleasantries. My wife's got Zumba tonight, and so I need to get back for the kids. I nodded, wondering who Zumba was. He reached into the backpack he'd brought with him, pushed a laptop to one side and took out a parcel, something wrapped in a carrier bag. A Tesco one, I noted with approval. We've been cleaning out Dad's stuff, he said, looking directly at me and keeping his voice even, as though he was telling himself to be brave. This isn't much, but we wondered if you might want it as a keepsake. I remember Raymond saying how much he'd admired it after that time you helped Dad. The words snagged in his throat and he trailed off. I unwrapped the parcel carefully. It was the beautiful red sweater, the one Sammy had been wearing on the day Raymond and I found him in the street. I could smell it, still faintly scented by its wearer with apples and whiskey and love, and I squeezed it tight, feeling the softness and the warmth against my palms, the gentle, exuberant Samminess of it. Keith had gone to the window and was staring out at the street.
an action I completely understood. When you're struggling hard to manage your own emotions, it becomes unbearable.